Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Booker Prize-winning author Roddy Doyle is now presenting a warm and witty portrait of our pandemic lives told in 10 short stories in a volume entitled Life Without Children, Love and Marriage, Children and Family, Death and Grief. Life touches everyone the same, but living under a lockdown, it changes us alone. In 10 moving stories written mostly over the last year, Booker Prize winner Roddy Doyle paints a collective portrait of our strange times. Doyle is the author of 10 acclaimed novels, including The Commitments, The Van, Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha, winner of the Booker Prize, and most recently, Love. Again, the new novel is Life Without Children. It is a great pleasure to welcome Roddy Doyle to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's really nice to have you on the program. From my understanding, March 2020 to March 2021 is basically between the months that these stories were written.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So what led you to that? Were you working on something else when you sort of fell into, okay, maybe this is what I should spend some time on?
You just answered my question.
Sure.
Or no, you answered your own question.
I'm sure you can do it more eloquently.
I'll have a stab. I had been working on a novel. I hadn't written very much. I was kind of getting to know the character and where he was and why I was writing about him. And I was away in the UK, half an hour flight from where I live in Dublin here. And Ireland went into lockdown in March, and the UK didn't. And for the first time, I felt far from home, you know. I was in an English-speaking country where a lot of the surnames are quite Irish. You know, I've never felt too far astray when I've been in England before, but this time I did. And it was disturbing. And as I, you know, spoke to my family and read the online papers in Ireland, and you know, the cinemas were shutting, the theatres were shutting, the pubs were shutting. There was a thing called social distance that I was reading about and trying to figure out how the practicalities of that worked. Nothing seemed to be happening in the UK. So I brought that home with me a few days later. I brought that sense of disconnect and that strong sense of anxiety, this burning need to get out of there as quick as I possibly could. That was my feeling, and go home to the safety of Ireland. And a few days later, when we were, you know, getting the hang of the lockdown and the rhythm of that, and took out the novel again to see where I was with it, and I realized it just made no sense. It was just gone, you know. The present day that it was set in no longer existed. And I put it aside. Some months later, I just binned it. I realized I was never going back to it. It's the first time I've ever done something like that, you know, just abandoned a piece of writing. But I knew it was the healthy thing to do, just get rid of it. Don't even think about it, because you're never going to go back to it. And I decided to use that feeling I had when I was in the UK, in Newcastle upon Tyne, to see if there was a short story, a moment in a life of somebody. So I used my feelings on a Friday night in Newcastle upon Tyne to inspire a piece of fiction, an Irish man among revelers at a time when he knows that back home in Ireland, nobody is reveling, if that's a word. And as I was writing that story, another came into my head. So I finished the first one and kind of sent it off to see what would happen and started on the second one. And I began to enjoy it, and I realized that actually the tone of this one was a bit different to the first one, because we've moved on a month or so and we're getting used to the new language and the new restrictions, so to speak. And we're looking forward to the lifting of some. And so it seemed to me, as I wrote, even though it's only a short space of time, 12 months, I don't think I've ever lived in as shifting and as changing a 12 months in my life. And I tried to make sure that the stories as I wrote them kind of reflected that somehow, or captured that somehow. So the stories kept me going, really, creatively, you know. I've never not been working on a novel since I started writing novels. So, and I write stories and I write other things too, but I've never not worked unless I'm on holiday. So it was great to have them. And it struck me the only way I could write about this time was in short stories, little moments in people's lives, rather than trying to, I don't know, see things with the big moving, shifting camera and try to capture everything. I didn't think there was any possibility of me doing that or even any wish for me to do that. So I thought stories were the way to go.
What was the story that you first started? Was that Gone?
No, the first one was Life Without Children.
That's a fascinating story because there's so much packed in there. It comes later in the collection, third or fourth story, I guess. That sets the tone, though, really, or that set the tone for you.
Yes, it did. Yeah, it was actually a relief to realize, oh, I can do something with all this. Creatively, I can do something with my feelings of anxiety and also the possibility of opportunity. I remember reading about people disappearing immediately after 9/11. I was thinking it must be really difficult to disappear. And I explore it, I suppose, more successfully in a way, given the one of the narrators of the story, Gone, does manage to disappear. But she uses the first days of the lockdown as an opportunity to just walk out of the house and not come back. And she knows that because the streets are empty, nobody's going to be seeing her go. And I thought, you know, this man just for a second wonders if there's another life for him. He's at a moment in his life, his children are reared, so he's not a father. His self-definition, while it includes fatherhood, it's not as vital as it used to be. He's probably feeling redundant and he's wondering, is there another kind of life there for me? So he's imagining himself just disappearing into England instead of going home to Ireland. It's not something I've wished myself, but the idea, like a lot of ideas, was in my filing cabinet. You know, had nothing to do with the pandemic or anything like that. I just thought I can use this idea by dropping it into the last few weeks I've lived through, you know? So, it's nice that you said there was a lot in it, or what, I can't remember the phrase that you used, because it was as if I had the opportunity to use two or three ideas I had for a short story in just the one short story.
And it reminds us, and sometimes we can't remember things that far back, but you know, this was a year, year and a half ago, and yet we forget how we feel because things have changed so. And one of the things that struck me in the title story, Life Without Children, is you write, in the hotel foyer, he didn't want to put his hands on the counter. He didn't want to hand over his credit card, which I thought, oh, yeah, there was that time where you didn't want to do that, where you didn't want to touch anything.
Yeah, only yesterday, I think it was, somebody put their hand out to me to shake hands with them. And I just, you know, I thought, I'm not ready to do that yet. So I put my elbow out so we could touch elbows instead, you know. I just wasn't ready to shake hands with somebody. And I never thought, you know, 2 years ago, if somebody said, you know, you're going to recoil from an open from an open hand offered in friendship. The idea that that would be the case, that it would be somehow threatening, was bizarre, you know, but it is, or was. And while I just thought maybe, you know, this person's being a bit enthusiastic here or a bit too optimistic. Right. I mean, there are still thousands of people being infected every day in this country, and it's a small country, but we are out of the emergency mode, all right. But it is, it's incredible how quickly we tend to forget that. But we were terrified in March 2020. We were seeing the images from Lombardy in Italy. You know, we were seeing lines of dead bodies, you know, and we were fully expected this to happen here in Ireland. Luckily, it didn't on that scale, but we were frightened. We were frightened of touching even the buttons to permit us to cross the road, you know, for pedestrians to cross the road. Maybe it's a psychological necessity, but we do forget very quickly how frightened we were.
Roddy Doyle is our guest. The name of the new collection is A Life Without Children. In that story, the man is caught in England as the Irish lockdown is looming. And here's a guy in his 60s and contemplating just not returning and allowing the pandemic, as using it as an excuse, really, to go off into a new direction and to rewrite his story. That's what I said. There's a lot going on there. To see it, to see that moment as almost a reset button.
I think what he sees himself doing is walking up to the possibility of it. and making one step towards the fact of it, and then stepping back and deciding, well, I can do it, but I'm not going to. You know, but he does see it as a opportunity. I think it's that little point of his life. I remember when my own children grew up, you know, when they stopped needing me in that daily way, where there was no more school commute, where they were independent, you know. They were still living at home, but they were independent. And I remember feeling a strong sense of redundancy, really. And it wasn't a nice feeling. And then you think you go through that, and you do. But it's a different form of redundancy than when the kids are out of the house, when they're gone. I suppose you wonder, what was that all about? You're still a parent. You know, the relationship is still there. It's still the most important one, possibly, emotional relationship you have. I'm not sure, but it's still vital. It's in your every minute thought or whatever. Yet you wonder, what was that all about? Because, you know, they're gone now. They're up and running. They don't need you. This man in Newcastle is, you know, he's at that stage where, you know, he's wondering, what was that all about? And instead of being a 28-year-old man wondering what parenthood would be like, he's a man in his early 60s who can never be a 28-year-old man again, if that makes sense. That's and he's not in a position to take the other route, as was an option when he was 28. There's not much psychological depth to it, because I think it's a feeling an awful lot of us would have on occasion. What was that all about? But I suppose the key is to try and make it a bit fresh in fiction form.
Well, and the opposite happened to many parents, right? Where their kids had nothing else to do and were had a their security blanket of younger kids or who were out of school, returned home. They came back and lived under their parents' roof for a while.
And that happens with another character in a story called The Charger. His daughters, right, who he adores, come home. They all come home for the pandemic, as they say. You know, it's almost as if it's some sort of religious festival. You know, the pandemic. They come home, and they're occupying their own rooms, their old rooms. And one of them is, you know, as he's roaming around the house, one of them is conducting a Zoom meeting, which he finds quite mysterious, on the other side of the door, and he's very, very impressed that his daughter seems to be leading this meeting. He has no idea what it's about, or can't remember her formal job description, but it's out of his own work experience, but he's very proud. And another of his daughters works in a supermarket, and up until recently she was the problem child, but now she's the vital worker. She's their pride and joy, because she goes off and does her bit for the country, in a way, by working in a supermarket and doing dangerous work, because she's inhaling and exhaling in the early weeks of the pandemic. So again, he's desperately proud of her. You know, he'd have had sleepless nights, I'd say, wondering, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with this child? And she's an adult, and here she is, you know, the frontline worker. And it's great. They're all a mystery to him, because in a way, again, he loves them, he adores them, but in a sense, he doesn't really know them, because they're their own adults now, if you like. And he's their dad. So he behaves like the dad. He makes them laugh. You know, he pretends he doesn't understand things. There are other things he doesn't understand genuinely, and they find that amusing. But yeah, so it's and there's another couple in a different story, worms, who dread the idea that their children will come back.
Right.
They dread it, because it's kind of a love story, because, you know, 30 years beyond their marriage, they've fallen in love again somehow. They've successfully done it, almost accidentally done it. They've looked at each other and realized, oh, I like him, I like her.
And that's a very musical story. I mean, basically, you're talking about earworms, these songs that resonate with these two characters.
Yeah, I suppose, like a lot of men, the central character, he's like a lot of men. He'd hoard his own music, you know. He'd have his own favourites, but he wouldn't be sharing them with anybody, really. You know, the whole notion of sharing is foreign to him. It's like, you know, you go to a restaurant and the women are sharing, but the men, try taking something off a man's plate, you get a fork in your hand, you know. And it's the same with the music. He'd be one of these men, and I you know, I'm saying this with a certain amount of confidence, because I am one of these men who'd scour who'd scour Spotify looking for some glorious piece of music that nobody knows about, you know? And you'll tell one or two people, but no one else, because this is too good to share, and if it becomes too popular, you can't like it anymore, you know? So he's got all this music that's in his head, involuntarily in his head, so to speak, you know. He's mystified by these earworms. They're not unwelcome. They amuse him. And then he realizes, again, it's a bit of an accident. And here they are, both in their 60s, looking at each other. His wife likes music too. She has her own Spotify account. He had no idea. And when he mentions music, it's familiar to her. She knows it. And she has her own taste. And they end up like a pair of teenage girls, really, their heads close together and sharing buds as they listen to music and make each other laugh, you know?
Which is beautiful. And you mentioned there was a part in there where he remembers an interview with Glenn Campbell or Jimmy Webb and thinking of the song Wichita Lineman. Yes. Mm-hmm. And how they both, he thinks of it and then goes home and tells his wife.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, you know, it is a favorite song of mine. I mean, can you imagine somebody saying, oh, I don't like that song?
That's a great point. Yeah.
But I read a book about Wichita Lineman, the writing of it and the recording of it, and I've seen Jimmy Webb perform several times. Never saw Glenn Campbell, unfortunately, but I went with friends to see Jimmy Webb not so long before the first lockdown, and it was a glorious show. He did a lot of talking between the singing and giving, you know, telling great stories about the songs. But so I knew a little bit about the writing of Wichita Lineman, and I just thought, well, this character would know a little bit about Wichita Lineman as well, you know. So, you know, it was in my head, so why not use it?
Roddy Doyle is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Life Without Children. It is a collection of stories. One of the stories in the book is called The Funeral, and you write a great line. The Irish do funerals well, they say. Death doesn't frighten the Irish. They know all the right words. Because you do tackle death. This is, after all, a pandemic that is killing people.
We do. And, you know, I think most people, you know, certainly most of the people I know, if they were asked, which would you prefer to go to, a wedding or a funeral? What most would say, a funeral, please, if there's one on. They're much better in some way. I don't mean as a, you know, as a party or anything like that.
No.
But we do them much better. I think, you know, having been to a lot of funerals in the last years and having, you know, gone through the death of my parents and some close friends, and I do know the comfort of words and the comfort of silence sometimes, and just facial expressions and numbers, actually. When you're at a funeral and, you know, a parent's funeral, and you look up and around and you see that there are a lot of people have come to pay their respects, it is, to me, the fact that it was a huge comfort came as a surprise to me. I'm aware that the whole ritual we go through here in this country, sometimes it's a very strict ritual, you know, in cities less so, but we do it well, you know, and that was taken away from us during the pandemic because you couldn't go to funerals. You weren't allowed. I'm lucky insofar as no one close to me died during the pandemic. Mm. But lots of people I know had family, close family, siblings, parents, you know, loved cousins who they grew up with who died. And in a lot of cases, they weren't able to go to the funeral because it was limited to 10 and they couldn't go. And it was a lot of anger. And I'm sure there was anger at the state for imposing this rule, and very understandable. The rule is what was understandable at the time, and the anger was understandable. And then I know of cases where there was anger within families. How come she can go and I can't? And I found that perfectly understandable as well. So I was imagining, as you've read the story, so you know, I was imagining the deep hurt of a son who isn't allowed to go to his mother's funeral. And the deeper hurt knowing that actually his mother planted this little bomb years before the pandemic. So the pandemic just gave another brother the opportunity or the excuse to exclude this man. And the pain that that causes And the comedy in it, and there is comedy, is that it's the glorious kind of logic of a drunk man, because he wakes up absolutely clear, totally knowing that he's stone cold sober, that he's, you know, slept off the drunkenness. And by the time he gets to the bottom of the stairs, and he can't account for how he got down, but by the time he gets to the bottom of the stairs, he realizes he's still drunk and he's still in, so to speak, the day before. And there's the drunken logic he goes through, but it's masking the deep, deep hurt and the anger and the sheer anguish of it all, you know, that the circumstances, yes, the pandemic made sure that the numbers were very restrictive in terms of how many people could go to bury his mother, so to speak. But his mother made sure that it was going to be fraught in the first place, regardless of the pandemic.
I think the story in the collection that struck me and stayed with me the longest and probably the most vividly is a story called Masks. Tell us about how that came about and about that guy, about that man.
Observation, really. I don't know about where you are, but where we are, you know, in the early months, or rather probably for the first 3 months or so, we were allowed to walk 2 kilometers distance from our house mm-hmm. once a day. It could be a trip to the supermarket. It could be just a walk. I'm lucky in that the bottom of my street, Dublin Bay, is there, and I can walk alongside Dublin Bay, or got a bike and cycle along Dublin Bay. It's a great walk, you know. The tide is in at different times of the day. The weather changes, you know, several times during the day. The seagulls will entertain you. And it is a great, great walk. So I was able to do this once a day. Walk out 2 kilometres and walk back. At some stage, masks became mandatory. We tend to think that masks were mandatory from the beginning, that they were a thing, that they were, if you like, part of the dress code of the pandemic, but they weren't at first. And there was a lot of discussion here on TV and on the radio about whether they should be mandatory or whether they just confuse people or make people complacent, or, you know, whether they were any good in the first place. And then seemingly overnight, they were mandatory. People being people, also overnight, they became litter. I remember the first time I saw a mask on the ground, and it was a real shock. Because these things were supposed to be lifesavers, you know. They were supposed to be the difference between, literally the difference between life and death. And they were supposed to be reassuring insofar as if you wore one, there was a possibility you wouldn't contract a disease, and also a possibility that you wouldn't give it on to somebody else. And yet, here they were on the ground. And I remember the first one I saw and thinking, God, it was like seeing some deeply personal piece of hygiene somehow or other, something really, really private on the ground. And then I moved on a bit, and there was another one, and another one. And there were as many masks on the ground as there were cups from the coffee stores. And they shouldn't be on the ground either. But, I mean, I'm not shocked by a coffee cup, you know, a cardboard coffee cup, but I was by the masks. I'm not anymore. They're like leaves on the ground, really. While I was walking at different times of the day, I often saw the same men, you know, striding along alone. I sometimes walked with my children. 2 of them were at home here at the time, or with my wife. And sometimes, or more often than not, I have a couple of dogs and we walk the dogs. I never said, it's 10 o'clock, I'll go for a walk now. I tried to vary it during the day, you know, had a look at the weather and the rest of it. But these men seemed to be out every day at this. And I wondered, were they walking back and forth, back and forth, back and forth? Because they had absolutely nothing else to do. And there was a grimness to 1 or 2 of them. They were just striding ahead. They weren't looking left or right, you know. And other people began to, you know, as the weather changed, you know, the jackets disappeared and people began to wear shorts, or as often happens, it's no longer just, you can't just walk, go for a walk now. It has to be a hike, and you have to have gear that'll help you walk, hike, you know, even though you're only going 2 kilometres and back. You have to pretend you're, I don't know, going up the north face of Kilimanjaro. And yet these men still wore clothes as if they were heading off to work. And I began to imagine a man who lived alone, and the scaffolding of his life was the commute and the job and the commute home. And it's taken from him, and he's lost. He has nothing else. So that's where the story came from. The mixture of being shocked by the masks on the ground, and then imagining what was going through the heads of these men. They may have been perfectly happy, perfectly content. They may have been looking at me and wondering, what's wrong with him? He looks grim. You know, I think it's the kind of, what would you say? It's the standard, you know, I don't know. Men reach a certain age, I think, where people regularly ask, are you okay?
Right. Everything all right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Just exactly. Checking in. You okay?
Yeah.
But you had a job to go home to, and which is a solitary job. Writing is a solitary profession. And yet you're still obviously impacted by a lockdown and by a loneliness, I assume, that we were all impacted by. And yet you are also able to fit that into what you do.
Yeah, in some ways, the stories were a lifesaver because I could write them. 2020 was going to be a really busy year for me. I had a novel coming out, I think it was May of 2020, and I had three theatrical productions. A musical based on one of my books was touring the UK. A play I'd written some years before was going to tour Ireland and then the United States. And a version of Peter Pan that I'd written was going to go on stage for the Christmas period, you know, the holiday period, November into the new year. So I had a lot to look forward to. And within, you know, about a week of the first lockdown, the publication of the novel had been pushed and one of the stage productions was cancelled, just cancelled outright, and the other two were postponed. My diary was empty, you know, and there's a big difference between being able to work alone and having to be alone. Huge difference. You know, I do work alone, but I'm not a recluse. I do like to get out. I do like the company of my friends. I do like sometimes just to sit in a pub and have a very slow pint alone, but just to be in the noise of chatter. You know, I love it. And all this stuff was gone. So, I work alone. I recently got an office in the city centre so I can get out and get on the bus and, you know, walk around the city centre and just get into the life again, you know. Just to sit in cafes sometimes and look out the window and see the place coming back to life.
Again, Roddy Doyle's new collection of stories is Life Without Children. It is published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program Bookmark Us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.